This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. How have states responded to widespread protest in 2020 over police abuse? And what's the trend in state laws for criminal justice more broadly? Robert Ault, in a report for the Federalist Society, details how states alter their criminal justice systems. We spoke last month.
A lot has happened since we last spoke about criminal justice reform and what states are doing on criminal justice reform. I, at the time, lived in Louisville, Kentucky, which had, you know, a pretty bad year in 2020, all things considered, both as everybody else had with the pandemic, but also the killing of an unarmed woman in her own apartment by police searching for drugs. And I wonder about the reforms that states have made in the wake of the death of George Floyd and that sort of thing. So to begin here, what kind of reforms have we seen to either policing or how police interact with average people?
So I think if you take a look back at 2020, that really was one of the dominant themes. Following George Floyd's death, state and local governments enacted policing policy changes designed to make law enforcement agencies more transparent and accountable through civilian oversight boards. They modified police training, techniques, and tactics through a ban on chokehold restraints and use of crowd control weapons. A lot of this was done through state and local initiative process. If you took a look and just, you know, sort of a tremendous amount of that. But in addition, there were some statutory changes. So one that's probably worth highlighting, just to give an example of the broad range of reforms that we saw, was Colorado. It enacted two policing bills covering a broad range of police activities. So, for instance, it required officer dismissal for unlawful use of force, required officers to give crowds at protests and demonstrations advance notice before using crowd control agents such as pepper spray and tear gas. It banned qualified immunity as a legal defense for law enforcement officers in civil actions alleging violations of constitutional rights. It banned the use of chokehold restraints. It required officers to intervene if another officer uses unlawful force. I mean, that seems to be absolutely 100% directed at the scenario that we saw in the Floyd issue. It requires officers to use a legal basis for stopping an individual and requires officers to wear body cameras and release all recordings of incidents to the public within 21 days after the incident. So a pretty, that was probably one of the bigger packages, but you saw quite a bit of this. As I said, many states went on to ban chokeholds. You look at a state like New York, which went further by making aggravated strangulation by police officer a new crime. This I think was sort of the general thing. But as usual, when we're looking at sort of the way that states approach it, different states approach this question differently. Tennessee actually enhanced penalties for offenses associated with riots and protest activities. So you saw, in response to some of the civil unrest that happened after Floyd's death, you saw Tennessee go the other way and crack down on unrest.
Yeah. So to what extent was there overlap? That is to say, some states seem to have created new crimes or harsher penalties for police who violate people's rights. But as you mentioned, Tennessee making it a little more dicey to engage in a lot of protests. So, were there states that did both?
I don't recall actually seeing the number of states that sort of increased the penalties with regard to protest were outliers, I'd say, overall on the year, despite the fact that obviously the people across the country were outraged with some of the property destruction and crime that occurred during some of the unrest. But that seemed to be, I think for the most part, perhaps this was a rational response by the public, which is to say those issues were adequately addressed by laws that were already on the books. It already was illegal to set fire to a business. And so we didn't need to pass a new law to address that.
All right. So with respect to policing, New Mexico this year and Colorado last year, I don't know if you mentioned with respect to Colorado, they eliminated qualified immunity.
Yes. Yes, no, that was a pretty substantial change in law, and you've got a broadened move to re-examine this. There was the Justice Thomas dissented from the denial of review in a case with regard to qualified immunity, asking whether or not we should re-examine this doctrine. And so I think you've seen both within sort of the think tank and scholarly community a critical re-examination of this, but you've now started to see states actually enact that into law. So Colorado, as I mentioned, I think the first out of the gate to actually do that.
A lot of states had difficulties dealing with prison populations in during a pandemic. Did any of them alter their rules governing, you know, to the extent to which they're keeping people in prison versus allowing them to go on some sort of home confinement? Or what happened with sentencing broadly? And to what extent are states with respect to prisons better prepared for a pandemic down the road?
So a number of states went ahead and engaged in some form of early release program. Some of them did this through the functional equivalent of their Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. You know, a common theme that we saw was releasing individuals within X days of the end of their sentence. Oftentimes, there were restrictions associated with this. You know, they weren't going to release people who were habitual sex offenders, certain violent crimes. I know in Ohio, for instance, certain violent criminals, including particularly anyone who had been convicted of murder, was not eligible for early release, even if, otherwise the terms might have permitted it. This has probably been one of the more controversial themes from last year, as you've seen questions with regard to the increase in crime rates, particularly in some of in cities like New York. One of the questions is, to what extent did the early release contribute to that? I don't think we've actually got data that actually supports that, but it certainly has become a point of speculation. And so it will be interesting to see later on if there's data with regard to how many, if any, of the new crimes were committed by individuals who were out on early release.
Yeah, more broadly though, what do we know about the relationship between relatively lighter, or I would argue more rational sentencing, and crime rates in major cities and states?
Yeah, and so I mean, this is this also has been a major issue with regard to bail reform. So New York, obviously, this became a flashpoint. We talked previously about some of their bail reforms, and this became a significant point of contention. One of the major issues there, though, is sort of how it is that they actually effectuated the bail reform compared to some of the other cities that were considering it. Bail reform actually in 2020 had a fairly significant setback in California. There was a major initiative on the ballot which actually failed, which would have reformed the cash bail system. You know, I think those bail reforms that have been most effective have been those that actually look at the question of keying pretrial detention specifically to the two goals of public safety and appearance at trial, and recognizing that high cash bail does not necessarily assure public safety. At the Baca Institute, for instance, we've done a number of studies that have looked at individuals who were capable of actually posting high bail, but nonetheless continued to pose a threat to society. So having someone who's able to actually post $100,000 bail does not necessarily mean that they're not going to actually go out and wreak mayhem. In those situations, we want to actually take a look at the risk that the potential offender poses to society, not simply on their ability to pay a pretrial bail bond. So
yeah, it's good. There's no obvious relationship between somebody's level of wealth and their likelihood to reoffend or fail to appear in court.
Yes, and the flip side of that is you've got a number of individuals, and this is where you really end up having some some issues in terms of public policy. You've got a number of individuals who are picked up and aren't able to post relatively de minimis amounts of money. And so they end up serving jail sentences prior to their trial, where, number one, they don't really pose any serious risk to society or risk of flight. We're paying a significant amount of money to house them pre-trial, so it's a cost to the city in terms of this policy. And then the individual who's being held pre-trial, who has not been found guilty of an offense, is in a situation where they very likely are losing their job. They may be losing their housing, all of which makes them a less productive member of society. So, this is something where, particularly on the lower end, on some of these relatively minor offenses, this can be devastating to the individual. It's very costly to the community, and it doesn't really serve any purpose in terms of preventing future crime.
Are there any clear trends that we saw, extending from previous years through 2020 in sentencing or various reforms to the justice system?
Well, I think probably the biggest one, which we've chatted about when I've done my review of previous white papers that I've done for the Federalist Society, analyzing the trend in criminal justice across the states, is with regard to drug crimes. And we continue to see a liberalization at the state level. 7 states legalized or reduced state law restrictions on marijuana use and possession, which continues a multi-year trend. Vermont and Virginia amended their marijuana statutes through the legislatures, with Vermont decriminalizing possession but not the sale of marijuana, and Virginia effectively legalizing possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana and provided for sealing of post-marijuana conviction records. 5 states, Arizona, Mississippi, Montana, Oregon, and South Dakota, changed the law through ballot initiatives. And so by my last count, 15 states in the District of Columbia now have legalized adult recreational marijuana use, and 36 states have legalized marijuana use for medicinal purposes. Probably the most interesting among the states, just in terms of change, sort of the broadest change in terms of policy, was Oregon, which had already adopted a bill legalizing recreational marijuana in 2015. It's now adopted some of the most lenient drug rules thus far, legalizing adult and juvenile possession of small amounts of heroin, cocaine, LSD, and other drugs. Oregon also passed a measure legalizing psilocybin mushrooms for medicinal use, authorizing therapists to prescribe these mushrooms to patients with chronic mental health issues and terminal illnesses. So again, I'd say in terms of trends for 2020, that you see a continuation of the liberalization of the drug laws in the states, including expanding it from simple marijuana in Oregon to other drugs. You saw a pretty broad trend with regard to modifying policing rules, with a number of states jumping into the fray there. You saw a pretty significant trend related to COVID and early release across the states. Those are probably the biggest trends. Other things worth paying attention to that I think folks, particularly on the free market side of things, would be interested in was a growing trend in occupational licensing reform focused on former offenders. And, particularly, this is one where I think a constricting labor market has actually created quite a bit of an impetus, both by legislatures and by the business community, to seek out individuals who previously they, may not have been as interested in getting back into the workforce. And so 3 states, Iowa, Missouri, and Ohio, passed laws easing occupational restrictions on ex-offenders. Iowa's, is perhaps a good example of a change in law They declare that a licensing board may deny or revoke a license on account of a criminal conviction only if that board finds by preponderance of the evidence that either the individual has been convicted of an offense that directly relates to the duties and responsibilities of the profession, or there's been a founded report of child abuse against that person. So that, I think, is a promising trend that we're seeing across the country with regard to occupational licenses. And, you know, this is one of those areas you can tell by the tailoring of that. I mean, it's a little bit of tricky business where you don't want the sex offender working in a daycare. I mean, there are restrictions that make sense, but there are some pretty broad scale restrictions. We've talked about this in the past, I think, where, back a number of years ago, Ohio, Texas, some other states, in their prisons, they would train, sort of individuals who had been convicted of felonies with barbering as a skill. But then, in fact, the barbering or cosmetology commissions would have placed restrictions which made it impossible for an individual convicted of a felony to get a license. I mean, these are the sorts of things that make no sense. And so we've been able to chip away at some of those one at a time. I think in both Texas and Ohio, for instance, the states ultimately eliminated those restrictions. But it's one of those things, you peel back the first layer of the onion and you find additional layers. So right now in Ohio, for instance, the number one training program for individuals who are incarcerated for felonies is HVAC repair and installation, which, again, this is a good profession to train these folks into, but there are extensive restrictions with regard to practicing HVAC in terms of their ability to get licenses. So we're looking at that. This new law that passed in Ohio will help. It's a much broader scale approach to that particular problem.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, so many states have legalized cannabis for either medical or recreational purposes, and people who may have faced convictions for felonies related to cannabis can't participate in that market. Mm-hmm. And that it seems odd for two reasons. One is, you've legalized it. Why can't we wipe some of those crimes off of these people's records? But also, maybe there's a lot of institutional knowledge there.
Well, and to that point, some states have begun to address those sorts of issues through expungement statutes. And so Michigan, for instance, this past year passed a major expungement statute, making it easier for individuals to go ahead and get a clean slate after they have served their time. And that's a trend that you're also continuing to see across the states, particularly with, and I think the example you gave is key, particularly as the states have begun to liberalize their drug policy. Many of them have concomitantly, even if they're not doing broader scale expungement provisions, they're passing special expungement provisions with regard to prior drug offenses. Something else I think is worth taking a look at is in the Fourth Amendment context, search and seizure modifications that were made. Two states passed reforms I think are worth noting. The first, Michigan passed a proposal which amends the state's constitutional protections against warrantless searches and seizures of a person's house or possessions to explicitly include electronic data and communications. This is one where under the Supreme Court's recent decision in Riley, that would be covered. But I think in this particular case, they were seeking to make it clear that state law comports with that broader understanding. The other law worth noting, I think, is Virginia, which passed a law modifying search and seizure protocols for routine traffic stops. Essentially, the statute prohibits law enforcement from stopping vehicles for certain petty offenses. Think about operating a vehicle without your license plate light, or without a brake light, or with an exhaust system that has excessive noise, window tinting, these sorts of petty violations. under this, evidence obtained as a result of an unlawful stop, which is to say a stop for those purposes, is inadmissible in any trial or other proceeding. The law also provided that an officer may not lawfully stop, search, or seize any person, place, or thing solely on the basis of the odor of marijuana. And I think, you know, that is another one of these cases where you take a look at the impact of the modification. Virginia passed a law which functionally, what it did is, I think it reduced minor possession to like a $25 fine. So it functionally decriminalized simple marijuana possession. And so along with that, they went ahead and modified the rules with regard to searches and seizures related to to odors of marijuana.
Yeah, it's weird because, in 20 years ago, the smell of marijuana is probable cause anywhere. And now, boy, it's really would be really hard to argue that it is probable cause anywhere, given that you could possess a legal plant that smells like pot but isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and again, I mean, I think this would seem to be a logical change based upon how it is that Virginia, treated simple possession. The change here, I think, though, the broader change with regard to sort of the minor offenses, really, it's sort of an interesting change in light of prior Supreme Court precedent with regard to, what we commonly refer to as pretextual stops, which is to say, under the Wren decision from the Supreme Court in 1996, if the officer has a basis for pulling someone over, say the taillight out and so forth, that is a legitimate stop, and the officer can then engage in an investigation for other illegal activity. And the court isn't going to look in that circumstance as to what the subjective motivation is of the officer. If the officer pulled over an individual, believing that perhaps that there was some other criminal activity, that there were drug use, but he wouldn't have had a legal basis for pulling them over for that. If he has a basis with regard to the taillight out or something, he can pull them over and engage in the investigation. This is essentially... it is a fairly significant shift because that modifies. The officer can no longer rely upon the minor violation to pull over the vehicle, and it's expressed under the statute that any evidence that would be found pursuant to that unlawful stop would be inadmissible.
Robert Ault is president of the Buckeye Institute and author of a new report for the Federalist Society detailing how states alter their criminal justice systems. We spoke last month. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.